Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Hi there. Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and also director of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project.
So some people think that the smartphone is the drug of our era. People are constantly looking at their phones, communicating, using apps, posting photos, reading stories, watching videos. Our politics are online. Our economy's online. Our culture's online. We live increasingly in a virtual world that's so all-consuming, it sometimes feels that it threatens everything else. But those worlds are not neutral. They are created. They are provided for us, often by companies that are as powerful as any we have had. Those companies and also in politics, political parties want us to look at certain things and to look at them in certain ways because it promotes what they see as their bottom line. So what does this all add up to? Where are we going? Where are we? Today, Sam and I have as our guest James Williams, who recently completed his doctoral work in philosophy at Oxford University. And before that, had worked for Google as a technology and business strategist. And James is the author of a new book, Stand Out of Our Light, Freedom and Resistance in the Attention Economy, which was published by Cambridge University Press. And James has been a guest at Princeton University, where his book was what we call the pre-read for all the incoming students who are beginning their academic careers there. So, James, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start with perhaps you telling us what is the attention economy? What do you mean by that? What is it? And why is it relevant?
Yeah, well, I guess, broadly speaking, the attention economy is this environment, this ecosystem of products and services that we kind of live amidst every day now that competes for our attention as the primary business model. A lot of that is driven by advertising as a business model, but not all of it. So it's just this kind of relentless competition for our attention from our digital products and services.
And is this more powerful than advertising in previous eras? So you have books and histories of the lure of commercial advertising on television or in print and how it shaped our preferences. And you're talking about the world of digital media. Are you arguing that it's qualitatively different in terms of what it can do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of the difference between a rainstorm and a hurricane is sometimes how I think about it. I think part of that is due to just the sheer amount of information that and data that can be input into the system to inform the way it what it puts in front of us, how it persuades us, manipulates us. A part of it's information, but I think part of it is also kind of the unbounded nature of persuasion in kind of digital environments. So, previous forms of media like radio, television, they were kind of bounded in space and time somewhere. You'd sit down to listen to it. You'd get up and walk away and do something else. With digital media, we carry it around with us all the time. And, if advertising was kind of this little sort of exception to the rule in the way that the medium was giving us information, now it's kind of, it feels like it's just become the rule. And advertising has kind of cannibalized a lot of the ultimate design goals of the system. And then so I think, thirdly, I would just say it's more centralized than ever.
So the barriers or the walls between advertising and substance or content, as it's called, is becoming thinner or harder to discern in the digital media. And you want to argue, just for our listeners, that all this technology, it's not simply that it's a distraction, as we often hear, that we can't pay attention to what we are trying to pay attention to, but that it actually shapes what we think we should be paying attention to. Is this at the core of your argument?
Yeah, broadly. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do with the book is kind of deepen the conversation on all of this. We have talked about distraction as just kind of these momentary, distractions of what, cognitive scientists sometimes call the spotlight, like what I'm looking at, what I'm listening to right now. But what I wanted to do was really get this, there's this kind of deeper tradition in disparate literatures about attention and the way in which attention is in a pretty real sense kind of who we are. It's kind of the medium of our life in a sense. And William James, the psychologist, kind of said attention is the essential phenomenon of will. And so basically, kind of the book is kind of just following through this idea, well, if attention is the kind of essential phenomenon of will, of who we are, and the will, our will is the basis of, like, you know, the authority of democracy, you know, what does this mean? What does the attention economy mean for politics?
Well, let me continue with that a little bit. I mean, I think when you say attention, there's a narrow definition of attention that a neuroscientist, I'm a neuroscientist by training, that a neuroscientist might have something having to do with basically an attentional spotlight where my sensory apparatus is focused on one thing. But there's something here going on that's kind of interesting. As I read this book, by the way, I want to encourage our listeners, it's a pretty short book, an enjoyable book, Stand Out of Our Light is almost within the attention span of modern life, but it's like little pensées, a few about 10-page chapters. But speaking as a neuroscientist, I wanted to get into why this is that there's something qualitatively different. It seems to me that these constant distractions are really good at capturing our attention. It's like squirrel, and then, you know, email shows up on my screen, squirrel, text message, squirrel, and it's qualitatively different. It feels to me like we're not well evolved to handle this in a way that's different from books, that's different from telephone calls. So I want to talk about the qualitative difference between modern distractions and when they really, when it really got bad.
Mm. Yeah, like, I certainly agree that, like, one way of describing this whole situation is that, you know, the capacities we've been given by evolution are sort of mismatched or poor fit with this new environment. And there's a great book, The Distracted Mind, by, I believe, Gazzoli and Rosen, where they talk about kind of like the way in which our system for foraging for food has, we've kind of repurposed it in this new environment to forage for information. And so I think one element of the qualitative difference is, like, you know, it's one thing to forage for food if food is scarce, but it's another thing to forage for food relentlessly if food is abundant. It becomes kind of, you know, a never-ending task. So it's kind of like, you know, we're at a buffet all day, every day, and you know, our systems are telling us just eat more and more and more and more, and there's no kind of obvious stopping point built into the system. So I think it's kind of I think part of the qualitative difference came really with the advent of mobile networked general purpose computers that we carry in our pockets. You know, where basically there's just, you know, these kind of the ability to forage for information is just there, you know, in a frictionless way in our pocket.
All you can eat.
Exactly. All you can eat. All you can download.
In your book, you cite evidence that fairly recent study, I guess, that people with mobile devices will refer to them something like 150 times per day on average, and physically touch them 2,600 times. I will say that during the time that we recorded this, I've probably touched my mobile device 4 or 5 times. Now, it's to, pulling the curtain aside, it's to text with Julian. But so I'm not, like, you know, communicating with, you know, like, somebody else.
Give away inside info there.
Yeah, that's right. But just the fact that all this constant availability just makes it really hard to maintain a train of thought. Mm-hmm. So what are we going to do about that?
I mean, I think that's the sort of the million-dollar question. The epigraph from my book is from Aristotle, but the runner-up epigraph I was going to use was a quote from a guy who was in 1899 head of the Canadian telegraph system, named Erastus Wyman, and he was talking about the forms of media that were the best, and he said the ones that were best were the most, you know, instant. And he said there's no competition against instantaneousness. And I think that's kind of the question before. It's like, you know, how do we compete with instantaneousness? Or at least what kinds of impedances do we put in the way? You know, it's kind of similar to the, you know, there's kind of the slow media movement you've seen in kind of, like, you know, Norway and places like this. So I think it's a technological problem. It's a cultural problem that, you know, really is I think ought to kind of be, you know, on the front and center on the radar of pretty much everybody in the world today.
Well, my, you know, again, thinking about brain mechanisms, brains evolve slowly. It takes thousands of years for any adaptation to happen, many, many generations. And our brains are still, in some ways, evolved for small group interactions, groups of less than 100. We form alliances, rivalries, spread rumors. We tell stories in small groups. All these things we do in small groups. And we still have those 8 brains. And if we're lucky, then the capacity grows within the limits of what we can do during development. And I think of it as like the movie Mean Girls, except with spears. That's where we come from. And now here we are attempting to deal with stuff coming at us from all directions all the time.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like that scene in 2001, A Space Odyssey, where the ape throws up the bone that he uses to kill the others, and then it turns into the spaceship. It's pretty much been that quick, I think.
Right. The fact that we're the ape brains, and we're here we are trying to contend with this technological change. I want to just flip it back to Julian, but first I really have to do this. What about reflection about false information? Like here I am, I get something on my newsfeed, and there's some chance it's not true, and I've got this barrage. So talking about foraging for information, if you forage for information and it's scarce, then you consume each tidbit. And with great effort, I can take a piece of information and then collect 10 more pieces of information and figure out whether it's true. So now I've put this cognitive effort into curating the information. And, okay, which way does that go? Is it good that I collected 10 more to find out whether it was true? Did I go down a rabbit hole where I could have been doing something more productive? Like there's this illusion of getting lots and lots and lots of information. Mm-hmm. But really what I did is I just ate 10 potato chips.
Yeah, I think to follow the food metaphor, I mean, in public health, they'll talk about like empty calories, like and something has sugar. It feels like you're getting nutrients, but you're actually not. I mean, I think we could make a comparison with information. Some things might not be true. They might not be useful to our lives. They might not be, relevant to kind of the the lives we want to live, our goals. They might be sort of informationally empty. Calorically. So certainly I think, yeah, there's nothing in our information foraging, I guess, impulses necessarily that selects for the good calories rather than the empty calories.
So all this information comes at us, some of it true, some of it not true, some of it really what we shouldn't necessarily be paying attention to given our priorities. But I assume that information in the world of digital media competes with other structures in society. So you talk a lot about politics and the impact on politics, but digital media competes with political parties, with partisan identity that dates back generations or that is pretty deeply ingrained in an individual. Religion is another example, et cetera, et cetera. How do you weigh kind of what this economy or environment can do to a person in terms of shaping their preferences relative to these other pretty deeply rooted structures? Can they work against each other, do you think?
I think certainly the cultural background can either amplify, the effects of new technologies, or it can, counteract them. One of the things that I found interesting is that, certain cultures, certain countries seem to have picked up on some of these issues earlier than others. Some seem to be able to kind of, manage them better than others.
Any particular examples?
Well, I mean, I think I would call out maybe, one of the first countries to ever really kind of give sustained attention to this issue, I think, was the Netherlands. I'm interested why. I mean, I have a few theories, but I think another might be Norway, where they had, somehow they got, the majority of the country to tune in for, a few days while a boat was sailing through the fjords with just a camera on it. And, this was primetime television for them, kind of the slow media thing. Yeah. So I think that there are certain cultures, whereas I think, in the U.S. where there's such an emphasis on kind of output productivity, work, the kind of the Puritan work ethic, it seems like that's, kind of set the stage for a bit more of a kind of just inherent challenge with some of these things. So I think that's an interesting piece to it, but certainly kind of, this technology doesn't, we don't use it in a vacuum. But I think then it goes the other way too, the technology and our media is the lens through which we understand, these the representations of our identity, whether it's cultural, political, whatever. So it's also kind of a lens that distorts and reshapes our understanding of these things. So I think it's certainly like a bi-directional process. I don't think it's kind of like you just drop a technology in and here's how it changes things.
Although I assume part of what might be going on, at least in the U.S. context, is that some of these institutions have according to everything we know, weakened. So kind of the standing of government since the 70s, public trust in government has diminished. Same with religion, same with the media. So I imagine there's some replacement that's going on where this forum has even more power because it's not just competing with other institutions effectively, it's competing with institutions that have become weaker.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I think they're, in a way, they constitute, and I talk about this in the book, a lot of these technologies constitute, I think, new forms of government that we don't really have a word for yet. So if you think just about the sheer scale of platforms like, you know, Facebook or YouTube or Twitter, on the scale of billions of users, the ability to know so much about their users and, you know, shape their thoughts and behavior in certain ways. I mean, that's like no government has really ever had that scale and that degree of influence over its people, I think.
And another interesting part of your book, you have a section or a few pages on moral outrage and kind of the prevalence of moral outrage in a pretty fierce fashion in this world of digital media. You write that you're most likely to experience moral outrage when you feel not merely angry about some perceived misdeed, but angry and disgusted. And then you really go on to show how important this is to the discourse and rhetoric of this world that you're writing about. Why is this so pervasive? It's not inevitable, but why has it taken on this form?
I mean, I think when we're outraged, it satisfies a lot of psychological needs at once. It, you know, gives us a sense of, you know, solidarity with other people toward a cause. It gives us an opportunity to signal that we're trustworthy. It gives us this sort of, you know, Manichaean sense of right and wrong, like I'm on the good side, they're on the evil side, all these things that we, you know, don't always have in our day-to-day lives. And so I think, you know, it's also kind of just a very expedient way to get something done by, if you yell and are angry about something, it gets attention. And I think we see this happening more and more, not just in politics, but in many domains, that this is kind of becoming the default mode, I think, in academia even as well, which is, you know, maybe the best example of a self-contained attention economy. It just seems like I see people I know becoming more like Twitter every day.
Yeah. Well, emotions organize our mental responses. That's what emotions biologically are for, is to organize our brains towards a goal. And so we capture that emotion captures us and gets us moving towards a thing. And back in the day, that was useful in catching the gazelle or whatever the heck it was
we were
doing.
But there's a phrase I use in the context when I'm talking about this in the book, right, that lawyers sometimes say, justice isn't the outcome, it's the process. And I think, you know, what I think these technologies make it easy to do is to do something that's, you know, politically expedient rather than something that's done on the basis of principles or, you know, due process or, you know, kind of the slower processes, but those processes that we take to be aligned with the values on which, you know, we want our society to be based.
I assume, I mean, and this is to Sam as well, that there's an element where this is easier also to do in that, A, it's an unfiltered world, much of it. So it's very easy to get, when you feel outrage, to express that outrage instantly. And there's platforms to get that sentiment out. And it's also, even though on the one hand, very intimate form of communication, it's totally impersonal and removed. And so I assume that makes it easier for a human anywhere to, you know, be as vicious or vile as possible.
Yeah, certainly the system doesn't optimize for compassion or nuance and makes it easy to have this caricatured view in our minds of, you know, the other side, whatever that may be.
Right. Twitter mobs, social media mobs, or, you know, whatever the kids are doing these days, TikTok or what have you. Right. Ways in which our emotions get amplified and we don't have to see the consequence of a live person. I've been targeted by Twitter mobs and it's otherwise rational people who are perfectly civil in everyday life are A-okay with dogpiling onto people who are just objects on their screen. Mm-hmm. It's like a video game where you get to shoot down the people on the other side of the aisle politically, or shoot down, you know, you get to tear down somebody who, in your book, you go into Cecil the Lion, and the guy who shot Cecil the Lion, like, ended up having his life threatened.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like we see this every day now, if not every hour, where there's just somebody who's been selected to be kind of the symbolic, you know, kind of the symbolic takedown of that day, where if you want to show that you're a good person, you sort of just perform outrage and disgust at at somebody. And it's, I think it's a kind of, to be honest, I think it's a kind of reputational terrorism. That has, you know, there's very little regard for kind of anything that we would really consider
but justice. If I could just follow up on that example, I mean, is there an incentive for a company like Twitter to have that conversation? Meaning, is that part of the dynamic here that they want that at some level because that fuels the likes and retweets and it fuels their platform unlike anything else as opposed to civil, boring dialogue? Is that part of how kind of we're being directed in a certain direction through a company?
Well, there's certainly value to them. I mean, if the business model is monetizing attention and more engagement means more money, then something like this that is maximally good at creating engagement, there will be a value there. I can't speak to their kind of incentives and motivations, but I mean, certainly, I think one stat I quote in the book was, Trump was estimated to be worth about like $2 billion, I think, to Twitter.
I think you said your claim was, what, one-fifth of their capitalization
something like that at the time, yeah.
Yeah, and so the thing is, so companies are good at maximizing the thing that they are created to do, right? Facebook and Twitter maximize capture of our eyeballs, and that's their business model. And so, look, we're good at maximizing gains in our little tribal groups. They're good at that. We're not good at thinking 50 years ahead. And so here we are, all these players who are good at maximizing certain things. So I want to take a little bit of our remaining time to talk about solutions. A few minutes ago, you mentioned that we have this new kind of governance where we don't even have a word for it, where Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or what have you control our minds. And so I think back to the legal principle of habeas corpus, where our bodies can't be imprisoned. Mm-hmm. And so what about habeas mentis, where our minds are captured? And what I want to know is, do we have any kind of model for how to move these things forward? I mean, honestly, to increase our mental freedom, to give us that space that you say has been taken away.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I think, in international law, kind of international human rights, freedom of thought is one of these fundamental human rights. And I'm not a lawyer, but talking to lawyers, my understanding is that, the case law and kind of just the precedent, it just isn't nearly as built up around this. And I've been talking with some people who are interested in kind of trying to push this forward. I think in an American context, the Constitution kind of assumes in the background a certain technological and media environment. And so the thing that was under siege, freedom of expression, is the thing that's more protected. I think, we can look and find kind of
a guy standing on a soapbox.
Yeah, yeah, or whatever. Exactly. Yeah. I think, in things like, freedom of association, freedom of religion, I think there are places where something like freedom of thought or freedom of attention or habeas mentis, I love that phrase, that you could sort of find that. What it looks like to make that more explicit in the context of American law, I think that's where a lawyer would probably need to come in. But I do think it's a pretty urgent thing to kind of update this. As I talk about in my book, John Stuart Mill, he talks about how freedom of thought is not just a complement to, freedom of expression. It's the prerequisite. Like, if we don't have kind of the freedom of thought, the ability to kind of really sort of, reflect and come up with this diverse set of opinions and ideas, then, we can express them, but it's not, it's going to be expressing thing, sort of a subset of what the full scope, the full range of options is.
Now, I want to turn this a little bit to corporate culture and what, if anything, could be done. You've worked as a technology and business strategist at Google, so surely this at some level informed your knowledge of how attention gets manipulated. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of work that you did at Google that illustrate this capture that we are subject to?
Sure. Well, I worked at Google for just over 10 years, and mostly worked in the area of search advertising. And, when I joined in 2005, there was this kind of it was a really inspiring kind of mission, which was about using the new affordances of the internet to change advertising, to make it less distraction-y and more kind of oriented toward people's intentions. And I think search is still kind of a good example of this. I think where you saw the industry go as advertising kind of further colonized the internet was just back toward these, you know, usual ways of these pre-internet ways of just grabbing people's attention. So like, and I think part of this is about, you know, the fact that what I think are very different types of activities. So like demand fulfillment, like, you know, giving somebody, they want to buy running shoes. So you tell them where they can buy running shoes. So demand fulfillment and demand generation. So telling people what they ought to want, or, you know, branding, these have all been put under the same umbrella term of advertising. And I think part of the challenge is like, we don't have good conceptual philosophical distinctions for talking about the different forms of advertising or different forms of persuasion generally. But I think what we just saw was the kind of the ascendance of, you know, these kind of traditional modes of persuasion and advertising on the internet. So I do think there's a, you know, huge opportunity to really, I mean,
amplifying hot emotions like, seems like you don't like people with darker skin. Maybe you like this website. Like 8chan, like just like advertising principles applied to, seems like you don't like people in this ethnic group.
Oh, right.
So that, yeah. It's the same, like technologically, that's neutral. What's the difference between that and wanting running shoes?
Yeah. So I think one thing that kind of these mechanisms of advertising do more often than not is infer what we want based on our behavior and other data inputs, as opposed to, you know, asking for explicit representations of what we want. And, you know, that not only gives them a sort of skewed view of us, but it takes away, I think, opportunities for us to actually reflect on what we want. It seems to me if we could reorient this whole project of what we call advertising around people's intentions, values, like a sort of a true sense of what they at least in some sense authentically endorse, then that seems like a pretty good way of phrasing where we would want to go with it all. But there aren't sort of the right incentives in place to kind of to force that, I think, at the moment.
Do you think it's possible? I mean, we started the conversation with your being here at Princeton, and I said one of my kids read your book. She's starting college there, and I was talking to her about your book this summer after she read it, and it was really eye-opening for her. And so she's the generation that has grown up using this and using this technology, and to get her to think about this as a medium that has particular incentives, that's being provided in certain ways, it's going to be a revelation for many, I would say, of that age. For the older people in this crowd, certainly Sam and I are part of that group, I think we have a little more distance from it, and so we can instantly see what you're saying. Is it possible for the younger generation to kind of get out of whether you want to see it as a prison or whether you want to see it as just a limited environment? Do you think it's possible through your book, but through other mechanisms, to get them to direct their attention differently? Or are we too deep into, you know, these woods to get out anymore?
Well, I think it's certainly possible for them to see the nature of the medium. I mean, I think it just is about creating or having some kind of counter environment, you know, a sense of distance, as you said, from which to see this environment. And actually, one way I think that we see a kind of yearning for this is in video games. So I think video games are actually a really interesting signal of the psychological needs of a culture. It's the dominant form of media in terms of revenue. You know, Red Dead Redemption 2 in its opening weekend was, you know, the highest grossing entertainment product of any kind in history. And if you look at what some of the most popular video games are, which they're not even really games in the traditional sense, what they're about, it's you know, this, many of them have a kind of post-apocalyptic theme where society, you know, the technical society is broken down, where you have to kind of rebuild the world from these, you know, raw elements, whether that's Minecraft or you know, going back to the frontier or whatever. But there's a sense for kind of, you know, a need for a skilled grappling with the world, a reconnection with nature, you know, all these things, I think, that kind of you could view as a sort of counter environment to this, you know, environment of digital media that they're inhabiting every day. I mean, and I say this as one of these people who inhabits these environments for this kind of psychological use. So I think that there's a way in which, you know, technologies, not just video games, but many others, can actually be part of the creating this counter environment to see. I mean, obviously, then there's another step to say, you know, okay, what are the incentive, the business models, et cetera, of the technologies that we use every day? And I think there's a place for kind of education in that, but then I think there's also a place for regulation and for, you know, better design, and so on and so on. So I think it's a really kind of a full stack problem, and I think they'll need a full stack of solutions.
And I assume that part of it will be non-commercial, non-political institutions kind of rethinking what they do at some level, so to create alternative incentives that can compete with this world. I mean, that seems to be the only way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, anywhere we can encourage these enclaves within society of, you know, depth of thought, a focus on kind of, you know, the higher values, the reasons for doing things in life. I mean, I think this is what the university is has been and is uniquely positioned to be. I mean, this is why I worry about, I mean, two of the societal institutions I worry about being compromised are universities and journalism. Journalism is pretty much already gone, in my view. There are a few places where, you know, there's kind of, there are holdouts, but yeah, I mean, it's very hard to look around and see, you know, media dynamics, societal dynamics that are working counter to these trends of immediacy, impulsivity. Yeah, so I think that to me, that's what makes this such an urgent issue.
Well, we hope that your book is part of the solution to improvement, and Sam and I will keep doing our work at the university as best as we can. But we are out of time, so we want to thank you. Once again, our guest was James Williams. And his book is Stand Out of Our Light, Freedom and Resistance in the Attention Economy, which is out with Cambridge University Press and available wherever you can get books. James, thanks for joining our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Listeners, if you have questions for us, you can email them to us at politicspolls@princeton.edu. Or even better, you can just tweet them at either of us. I'm at Julian Zelizer. And Sam?
I'm Sam Wang, PhD, also on Twitter. And Julian, we have our new website.
That's true. Plug it.
Politicspolls.princeton.edu. So if you go to your local friendly web browser, type that in, you'll get this episode, previous episodes, all you can eat.
And it's a great website. Princeton did a really wonderful job. You can even get information about us. And then you can go back to whatever you were doing and not be distracted, though.
No distractions. One anyway, task at a time.
So thanks for joining us, everyone, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.